From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The White House and Justice Department are pushing back today on news reports that some of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigators have come forward to say Attorney General William Barr alarmingly understated their conclusions. The leaks from Mueller's tight-lipped team came 11 days after Barr informed Congress that he concluded Mueller found no criminal conspiracy with Russians and didn't find enough evidence of obstruction of justice. This morning, President Trump tweeted that Democrats are fighting hard to keep the witch hunt alive, and White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders went on Fox News.
Democrats continue to show day in and day out that they're nothing but sore losers. At some point, they have to realize that they have been beat by President Trump in the 2016 election.
Let's bring in Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Editor. And Phil, the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, goes further. He's calling these anonymous investigators lying leakers. The New York Times first reported this story. The Washington Post reports that investigators say that evidence of obstruction was alarming and significant and more acute than Barr suggested. Your thoughts?
Well, all we have to go on here are the summaries given by Barr in the letters that he has sent to Congress. First, when the findings were given to the chairman of the Judiciary Committees and the ranking members, and then in a follow-up letter the Attorney General gave. So without seeing what the special counsel has included in this 400-page document that he summarized, the Attorney General, when he spoke to Congress, we don't have a good sense about it. But again, according to these press reports, what people who work for Mueller appear to be saying is that there's more to this than just what was in those communications by Barr for the Congress. That's why the stakes are so high for the release of the full report. That's why there have been so many calls for it to come out unredacted for the Congress and probably in a redacted form for the public to see.
Right. Yesterday, the House Judiciary Committee voted to allow its chair to subpoena the full report. They are asking for no redactions for them, not for, you know, release to the public. And the president has already said he wouldn't mind if it was released. But has that equation changed, do you think, at the White House?
That equation appears to be the same, with the caveat that the attorney general's position is the law protects a lot of the material developed by Mueller and the special counsel's office over their investigation. It includes foreign intelligence, which may have come from technical or human sources overseas. We don't know. We can infer that. And also from interviews given by witnesses to grand juries that were impaneled by the Justice Department in this process. That material under law is sensitive. Grand jury processes are supposed to be secret. And so although members of Congress could see what Mueller developed potentially in some kind of special secret form or in the secure facilities in the Capitol, there's probably no circumstance in which the entirety of the Mueller report would come out unless somebody were to leak it. But that's unlikely.
Well, investigators also reportedly wrote their own summaries of each section of the report, which they intended to be publicly released. So one would presume that high security information wouldn't be there. So what more do we know about that?
That's a great question. Yeah, we don't know what this work product is yet from the special counsel and his team. And if you have a 400-plus page government document, the common practice from other agencies, including the Justice Department, is to write an executive summary either of the whole thing or of the headings of the sections that you have in that report. And these are longtime professionals. They're some of the most senior prosecutors, analysts, and FBI investigators in the business. And so they know how to do this. This is how they've made their careers. So it stands to reason that there would be something like that that was produced by the special counsel's office for the attorney general. Barr has the discretion to represent what he wants based on what he's seen, because he and Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general that we know, are some of the very few people who've actually seen it.
Real quick while we have you, yesterday President Trump brushed off a formal request for 6 years of tax returns from the House Ways and Means Committee. Let's listen.
I've been under audit for many years because the numbers are big, and I guess when you have a name, you're audited. But until such time as I'm not under audit, I would not be inclined to do that. Thank you.
Well, today, two Republican senators, Louisiana's John Kennedy and Lindsey Graham, joined Democrats in saying they'd like to see those returns. I mean, people want to know, is it going to show, for instance, does President Trump have any business with Russians? Do you sense that those tax returns are going to be released?
Well, the Congress has given itself the power many years ago to get the tax returns of people in this situation. There's a so-called committee access provision, which dates back to 1924, actually, because of an earlier scandal in Washington. So if everything works as we understand, it won't be up to Trump whether or not members of Congress get these returns. They have the power to get them directly from the IRS. The question is, will that happen? And if so, how long it'll take?
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's about a month left in the public comment period for a big change in privacy rules for electronic medical records. Nearly all doctors use those records to keep track of their patients' care. They need those records to avoid medical errors. But there are flaws in the system that doctors and hospitals can't always talk about because of gag clauses in their contracts with the makers of the electronic records. Kerry Goldberg from member station WBUR reports those gags may come off soon.
Sitting at a hospital computer, Dr. David Bates politely declines to demonstrate his expertise. Bates is the chief of general internal medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and he leads research on electronic health records and how they affect patient safety. For example, an ideal system prevents a doctor from prescribing the wrong medication. A less than ideal system might let the mistake through or even make it more likely. Can you show me on your electronic health record an example of a safety issue?
I'd like to, but I can't. I would potentially be legally liable if I did so. It's true at most of the hospitals in the country. The reason is that there are gag clauses at many institutions.
It's not just the software code Bates can't share, he says. It's the screens that all hospital staffers can see. And without special permission from the health records giant Epic that makes the system, he's not free to share screenshots or videos of specific problems, even in the medical journals where doctors often warn of risks to patients.
And I've written about this. We've suggested that this really needs to be changed. And if you do have an IT-related issue that causes a safety problem, I think, as do other leading safety experts, that we should be able to share it with everyone.
Another expert calling for this change is Dr. Raj Ratwani, director of the MedStar Health National Center for Human Factors in Healthcare in Washington, D.C.
Electronic health records are a positive thing. The majority of clinicians would never want to go back to paper. Having said that, there are some unintended consequences to the technology. And these gag clauses in particular have prevented us from being able to really quantify that impact.
So it's hard to know just how many errors can be traced to electronic health records. But the doctor's company, a big medical malpractice insurance company, estimates that it's between 1 and 2% of their malpractice cases. What Dr. Ratwani at MedStar can say is that despite the gag clauses, he and others have documented some risks. For example, when an electronic chart makes it easy to mix up the spot where you fill in a child's weight with the spot for height, or to confuse pounds with kilograms.
Then we have an inaccurate weight for the child. And because of some of these issues, we've actually seen children being harmed because they receive an overdose or an underdose, but typically it's an overdose of the medication that then leads to harm. And there's several more examples like that, unfortunately.
Say a doctor wants to order Tylenol for an adult male patient at a very common dosage, 500 milligrams. The screen may show 86 different possible Tylenol orders, including some for children and women. That kind of overload is taxing for doctors, Ratwani says, and it can lead to the selection of wrong medications. Dr. John Levinson, a Harvard cardiologist, contrasts those busy screens with the in-flight dashboard he uses as a small plane pilot. The dashboard tells him exactly what he needs to know and no more.
And the electronic health records that I've used are absolutely atrocious at that. They show you a vomit of unnecessary data, which gets in the way.
Levinson is no Luddite. He's a technology maven who wrote an electronic health record system in the late 80s.
I think these electronic health records are good things, but you know, patient safety is first, second, and third. It has to be.
So when Levinson got word that Ratwani was asking for signatures on a letter to Congress urging more action to ensure the safety of electronic health records,
I sent it to probably 800 of my closest friends, and pretty much everybody has signed it.
The letter comes at a pivot point for electronic health records. The federal government is proposing a new set of rules based on changes required by Congress in a 2016 law. Among other things, the proposal would ban gag clauses. Dr. Andrew Gettinger is the chief clinical officer for the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology.
The proposed rule says that there is a growing recognition that prohibiting or restricting communication about health IT software doesn't promote safety.
The public comment period lasts until early May, and electronic health records companies are reviewing the rule. A spokeswoman for Epic says its contracts don't prohibit criticism and that technology companies need to keep code and screens confidential to prevent theft of their intellectual property. She says last year, Epic approved nearly all customer requests to share screenshots of its software. Dr. David Bates at Brigham and Women's Hospital says he thinks healthcare is safer with electronic health records.
But it's just not nearly as safe as it could or should be. If we were a little more effective at fixing these flaws.
And he says it's easier to fix problems when you can talk about them openly. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Let me take you back a few months to the election in November of 2018. Remember Florida? More recounts, and in the end, the Democrats in both of the big races, governor and senator, lost. Andrew Gillum lost to now Governor Ron DeSantis. Bill Nelson lost to now Senator Rick Scott. But one Democrat won her race statewide in Florida. Nikki Fried is now the Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. She's the only Democrat in statewide office in Florida, and she joins us now from Tallahassee. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
And I want to talk to you about a lot of things that fall under your new job. But I want to first start with marijuana, because you were a lobbyist for the marijuana industry. The state of Florida just expanded access to medical marijuana, made it possible for people who need medical marijuana to use it in a smokable form. How big of a deal was that?
Tremendous. What had happened, we had a constitutional amendment that passed in 2016, and there were 71% of our Floridians who voted for the constitutional amendment. And the legislature came in, and they created a very structured, regulated system, including banning smoking. And so I've been a huge advocate for the state to allow patients to be smoking medical marijuana. And the reason why I've been such a big advocate of this is I've seen firsthand patients from all across our country, all across the state, who are suffering some horrible conditions. And allowing them opportunities to have the purest of form of this medicine is life-saving and altering for so many of our patients who can't have tinctures or other types of vaporizers, which add different types of chemicals and things into the products, that a lot of patients need this pure form of their medicine in order to help them relieve any of their conditions. So this was a huge win for the patients in the state of Florida.
You also just named a director of cannabis in Florida. What are you hoping to still achieve on that front?
So this person is going to be twofold. One is to show a continued advocacy on behalf of the patients, making sure that we are looking at different ways to get information out to our patients, figuring out all the things are wrong with the current process and current structure, and getting some recommendations to the legislature next year. So we're creating advisory committees of patients, of doctors, of license holders, of pharmacists, to kind of give recommendations of moving the ball forward when it comes to expansion of medical marijuana. The other thing that Holly Bell is her name, comes to us from the banking industry. Mm-hmm. And so she has extensive banking background and had been working with a lot of the medical marijuana providers across the country to work on banking. Because what I've said, in my campaign, my own personal campaign account had been shut down because I was an advocate for expansion of medical marijuana, as well as receiving campaign donations from some of the members of the industry. So I firsthand have experienced what it means to not have a regulated marketplace for the industry. And so banking is one component of it that Holly brings to the table. And we also are advocating for not just access, but affordable access, which means getting insurance companies to start covering medical marijuana as part of the co-pays and a part of their annuals.
But is there anything that you can do on the banking issue if marijuana is still illegal at the federal level?
Well, one, I spent a lot, I was in D.C. last week advocating for the state's rights bill that is passing, that's in the Senate and as well as in the House, as well as a financial regulation bill that came through marked up on the House last Wednesday. But also here in the state of Florida, we have an Office of Financial Regulations, and that new regulator is somebody that's appointed by the cabinet. So our new financial regulator is going to be working with our state chartered banks and trying to make sure that there is a path forward for them if they so choose to take the risk, because you're right, it is still federal. federally illegal, and they still are under FDIC. And so, but yet, a lot of them are willing to get into this market. And so we need to make sure that our state is open for business for when it comes to these companies and these banks that actually want to work here.
Do you think that it's time for Florida to make pot legal recreationally?
I think that there is definitely a path forward. You know, as you've just seen the polls from, you know, from 4 years ago to today, that it is becoming something of yesterday's debate, and that we really are moving the ball forward. And we have a huge epidemic in opiates. You know, and we've heard from both of our governor and our attorney general that this is a priority, that we're losing 17 people a day on opiates. And a lot of the reasons we can get people off of them is giving them another alternative, such as medical marijuana, or in some instances, you know, full legalization. And this way, we have another option for individuals who are suffering from chronic pain or from injuries, and give them a way to get off of the opiates.
Does the new Republican Governor Ron DeSantis agree with you about that?
You know, he and I have actually not had that conversation. I know that he, too, sees the benefits of medical marijuana. He was, you know, he put that mandate on the legislature that they had to fix the smoking issue by March 15th.
I want to ask you about some other issues. The state of Florida had a terrible incident of red tide last year for more than a year, I believe. The coasts along the Gulf Coast of Florida, beaches were closed, a lot of sea life killed. Some point to agricultural runoff as a contributor. What do you see as the causes of red tide, or is there anything that you can do about the problem?
You know, so red tide, as I, you know, is one of the worst that we've seen throughout the state last year. And it really was a double whammy that we saw the red tide come through, and we also had huge discharges from Lake Okeechobee and some blue-green algae from Lake O. And when the two clashed together, created the extensive marine life deaths that we saw and erosion of our beaches. I mean, I was out there a lot during the campaign trail and talking to so many of our fishermen that have, you know, that's decades of, you know, generations of being out on the waterways and having, you know, no business, having no charters, which has a direct impact on the local economy. It was a $70 million hit to our local economy last year because of the red tide. So as I said, you know, as I went through and I continue to say today that we got to work on the science. What is actually the causing of the red tide? Where is it coming from? And make sure that everybody has a seat at the table.
And you don't think we know what the cause is yet?
It's a combination. We know that it's obviously nutrient runoffs, but exactly what pinpointing, I think everybody's got a piece of the puzzle that needs to be brought to the table. So between some of the agriculture, but also a lot of the development. You know, we've seen an increased amount of development across our state in the last couple of decades. And that is definitely a contributing factor. You know, more people means more pollution. And so we also have seen an increase in the amount of septic tanks that are right on our waterways. That needs to be converted over. And so this is not a one-fix solution. This is going to be something. This has been man-made. We want to make this better. It is imperative that we fix this, because if not, we are not going to have a state for my niece and my nephew and the children of the next generation. You know, people think of the state of Florida, they think of a few things. They think of our citrus, they think of our beaches, and they think of the little mouse in Orlando. And we need to make sure that we're all working together so tourists continue to come into our state and that we continue to thrive as an economic boost for the southern part of our country.
I want to ask you about the Everglades, another beautiful part of the state of Florida and a part of the state of Florida that's also facing some environmental challenges. There's a court decision that recently approved a plan by Cantor Real Estate to drill an exploratory well on some land it owns in the Everglades, despite opposition from the Department of Environmental Protection and from local officials. You called this court case infuriating. What do you think is going to happen, and will the Everglades be drilled?
You know, you're right. My comment was, this is infuriating. This waterway is a livelihood of our entire state. You know, 7 million people in South Florida live and die off of what comes out of Lake Okeechobee and to the Everglades area. If we start getting drilling done into that community, and God forbid that there's a spill, we are not only, you know, jeopardizing all of the ecosystem of that area, all of the natural life that's in, around the Everglades, but also the people that are relying on this. So DEP has a few more months to actually appeal this decision. I passed a proclamation and signed a proclamation urging my colleagues in the legislature to ban all types of drilling and fracking inside of the Everglades. This is, you know, to have a little bit of oil that can potentially coming out of the Everglades versus a type of damage that could cause that is not reversible is something that needs to be at the forefront of every Floridian's minds, and to make sure this is a cohesive voice on that this is not acceptable, and if nothing else but peer pressure on this company, that this is not what's in the right interest and the best step forward for the state of Florida.
You are the state's highest ranking Democrat. The state's governor is a Republican, as is the Speaker of the House, the Senate president, and now the two senators representing Florida in Washington. First of all, why do you think you were able to win a statewide race last time around when Andrew Gillum and Bill Nelson were not?
The way I've seen it is that we talked about issues that transcended party affiliations. You know, I talked about water quality like we just discussed and the Everglades and the red tide and the green algae coming out of Lake O. We talked about those and how to preserve our environment and natural resources. I talked about our concealed weapons permit and protecting our citizens. My predecessor allowed for 13 months background checks to not be done for the concealed weapons program. So again, this is not something that's a partisan issue. This is for the public safety. And then I talked about expansion of medical marijuana. Again, marijuana passed in the Constitution by 71%. That's not a partisan issue. And coming from South Florida, I'm a Miami girl, lived for 10 years in Broward County, a 15-year practicing attorney. I talked about issues that impacted people's lives in South Florida as well, in some of our urban communities. And so made citizens as they're voting say, oh, Department of Agriculture, the Commissioner of Agriculture actually is something that I need to pay attention to, member of the Florida Cabinet, dealing with clemency issues and voter restoration rights. And so I think that when people woke up and realized that it was not just agriculture, it impacts people's lives every single day, I think it allowed South Florida, it gave South Florida a reason to vote for Commissioner of Agriculture, which again is in my backyard, which I think gave me the extra 6,753 votes that put me over the top.
Are you going to endorse on the Democratic side for president?
I would imagine that as we get a little bit closer to the primary season and to our vote here in Florida, I will engage. So don't count us out. Make sure that you spend a lot of time in Florida because we are, in fact, purple.
That is Nikki Fried, who is Florida's Commissioner of Agriculture, a Democrat, the only statewide Democrat there in Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me today.
Dillon up ahead, Winston, no one near him, and he's going to come out with it, and Michigan State is headed to Minneapolis.
Okay, probably the biggest upset so far in the NCAA men's tournament. Michigan State pulling off a one-point victory to keep the top-seeded team Duke out of the Final Four. Michigan State will face Texas Tech this Saturday. On the other side of the bracket, the Auburn Tigers will play the Virginia Cavaliers on Saturday. And the women's Final Four games tip off tomorrow in Tampa with the University of Oregon facing Baylor and UConn playing Notre Dame. Joining us now is Here Now sports analyst Mike Pesca, who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And let's listen to a clip from Michigan State head coach Tom Izzo just after that win against Duke.
These guys hung in there through a lot of adversity, a couple of big runs. They found a way to win. But you know what it is? To be the best, you got to beat the best. And there's no question they're the best.
So Duke was seeded number one in this tournament. They were at the top of a lot of people's brackets, but Michigan State still pulled out that win against them. How do you think Michigan State is going to do against Texas Tech on Saturday?
Yeah, well, you know, Duke was the favorite, but it's a weird thing because after the first weekend of play, they won two games, but their betting odds got longer because people saw, these guys aren't invincible. And obviously, Michigan State saw the same thing. And whether or not they saw it, they play like Michigan State does, which is an excellent basketball team. Tom Izzo, after Duke coach Mike Krzyzewski, is the most storied coach in college basketball. I do have a little quibble with his statement of the adversity. Much of it was self-imposed, and who doesn't overcome adversity? That said, I want to get to your question. I think they're going to have a tough time with Texas Tech. I think Texas Tech is the toughest defensive team in college basketball. And Michigan State is often one of the toughest teams in college basketball. But it's one of those Mike Tyson-esque things that everyone has a game plan until you get punched in the nose. And I kind of think Texas Tech is going to punch them in the nose. So we'll see what happens.
Okay, we'll see about that one. And what about the Auburn versus Virginia game?
Virginia is a great defensive team, but the question has always been where will they get enough offense? And they got three-point shooting from Kyle Guy in the previous round. Auburn is an upstart. Auburn has lost one of its best players. So in the Elite Eight, I think the rest of the team rallied after Chuma Okeke was hurt. But I do think they will feel his absence. So this is why I think UVA is the favorite.
I just want to say for a few of those teams that will make it almost to the end, but not quite there, I feel your pain because the Fighting Illini from my hometown of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, made it all the way to the finals and then lost, and it was devastating. So anyway, there we are. What about on the women's side, Mike? We've got the semifinals tipping off tomorrow, three former national champions and one newcomer, the University of Oregon. What are you going to be watching for?
Oregon has, I think, the most complete player in college basketball. Sabrina Ionescu, she gets triple-doubles all the time, or enough of the time to set records, sort of the Russell Westbrook of the college game. However, against Baylor, they are the top team in the tournament. On the other side, you have Notre Dame against UConn. If this sounds like a replay, these two teams always play. They used to be Big East rivals. Do you remember last year when on a last-second shot, Arike Ogunbowale hit that jumper? Maybe if you forgot that, it's because she did the same thing in the championship game. So what I'm saying is Notre Dame is the champion. They have beaten UConn. I do think this iteration of the UConn team is maybe a little better than last year's team, even though they're a number two seed this year instead of a number one seed.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
And we will focus exclusively on the women's tournament in another segment on Here and Now tomorrow.
Do you ever fantasize about disappearing, really disappearing? No emails can find you, no unwelcome visits from old acquaintances, no bill collectors, no SWAT teams kicking down your door. Wait, what? That's what happened to Jameson Lopp when he was swatted. Someone called the police with a false claim about a shooting and hostage-taking at his home. It took some tense minutes to straighten it out. Then whoever made that fake 911 call called Jameson to say, expect more of the same unless you pay a ransom in Bitcoin. He works for a Bitcoin security company, so not a stretch there, but he's a libertarian who values personal privacy above just about all, and he set about erasing any trace of himself. So, obviously, we couldn't find him, but from the shadows, he reached out to New York Times security and technology writer Nathaniel Popper, whose piece is How a Bitcoin Evangelist Made Himself Vanish in 15 Not-So-Easy Steps. Nathaniel, we found in his not-so-secret office in San Francisco. Nathaniel Popper, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, first, where the story starts with the swatting, this is serious. We remember when a gamer called in a prank 911 call on another player. The responding SWAT team shot and killed an innocent man. So, you know, serious stuff. But other people might want to just get away from it all, and he did. Yeah.
The reason sort of Jameson's story is so interesting, it's an experiment in what it takes to disappear. Just how many points of contact we have where there's somebody who can sort of snoop on us and figure out where we are.
Let's preface by saying we hope we're not giving any, you know, really bad guys information about how they can disappear, but it's right there, you know, all over the internet as well. So let's start to do it. And first of all, is the way he contacted you. He called you, he, you know, wants other people to have this information, but he called you on a burner phone.
Yes, probably not too surprising to most people. Our phone is one of the easiest ways in which we can be tracked by the most number of people. And, you know, our phone number is so indelibly linked to our name, our identity. And so one of the things he did soon after the attack was get rid of that old phone, get rid of that old phone number, buy a new one that was not tied to him.
We'll explain how he did that in a minute. But he also got these throwaway phone numbers. You know, I know a lot of young people using these. What is this burner phone?
Yeah, there are a couple steps to it. One is having a sort of core phone number that is not linked to your name. But then on top of that, you can create these sort of proxy phone numbers to make a single phone call so that you're doubly removed from the people who are calling you.
As he told you, it costs just a few dollars and then you delete it and it's gone. And just staying with phones for a second, he says, stop using the phone for directions.
Yeah. When I go around, I use Google Maps. And of course, what that gives Google is a precise pinpointed information on where I am. Oftentimes, those apps are actually able to track us even when we're not using them for directions. You know, as we've learned, I think, in the last year with Cambridge Analytica scandals and so forth, even other apps that aren't the one that are giving you directions can sometimes tap into that information to get that data on where we're traveling over the course of a day.
So use a dedicated GPS device that isn't otherwise, you know, tied to him. But you also talked about him getting a phone that's not tied to him. And this all has to do with the number one thing he said to do, which is create a new corporate identity. Talk about that.
Again, this is probably not a step that most ordinary people are going to take, but it's sort of an interesting thought experiment. Over the course of the day, we all are requested to fill out innumerable forms when we order something online, when we sign up for a new service, when the HVAC guy comes to look at the furnace. You know, we're constantly writing down our name and our address. And so the first thing he needed to do was find something to put into all those forms so that he didn't have to put his own name and his own address. And the sort of obvious, I think maybe the obvious step was to create a corporate identity so that he could put that corporation in. And Jameson went one step further, which is that most corporations, you know, if you go to the state, you can find out who that corporation is registered to. And so what he realized he needed to do was go to states, and there are three states where you don't have to list the owner of the corporation. So you can have a sort of nameless corporation that becomes your new identity.
That's Nevada, Wyoming, and New Mexico for people taking notes. You do not have to have your name linked to the corporation. And once you have the corporation, then you can make everything tied to that. It doesn't necessarily have to be in your name. So the phone number, right, can be tied to the corporation. What about credit cards and bank accounts?
Some of the most personally identifiable information. You know, if you see my credit card account, you're going to know everywhere I shopped today, everywhere I walked, where I went to lunch. So he wanted to detach that from him. Now, most corporate credit cards are going to still have the name of the holder on it. He found some services that will only list the company name. And that can be a problem. Not all stores are going to let you use a credit card that doesn't have your name on it. And so he, at the same time, prepaid debit cards, which are essentially walking around with cash. And then he also just kept lots of cash in his pocket.
But I'm thinking, you know, he set up more than a few corporations just in case, as you write, an adversary figured out he was behind one. I'm trying to think, what is this guy running from? But anyway, here's how far he goes. First of all, he has to buy a new house because a SWAT team knows where his other house is.
They
knock down the door when whoever this adversary is called in swatted him. So he buys a new house, but he also does that with a cashier's check from his LLC bank account, pays for the house. So that's okay, that's good. Creates a new phony name for the neighbors, which he kind of gets used to, just so they don't know his real name. But then comes a problem. He gets a car and he says, buy a boring car. That's advice that he makes if you want to disappear. Buys the boring car, again, the LLC, the corporation, signs the papers, all great. But then he has to get a license. And it's the one place where you can't use a phony name. So he buys another house, just a stupid, really cheap falling down house, to get an address?
Yeah, that was the sort of most remarkable step he took. And I think sort of interesting insight that it's sort of the DMV. You know, if you want to drive and you want to be on good terms with the DMV, that's the one place where you need to give them a real address. So he said, I'm not going to give them my real address. I'm going to find some, you know, crappy little apartment, the sort of cheapest, most rundown place he could find that still had a street address. And that's what he gave to the DMV.
And a physical mailbox, in case you need a mailbox, although he recommends setting up a private mailbox, a remailing service, somebody who takes mail in for you and then remails it. I mean, just this is just really kind of wacky. But I'm sure people are thinking, the internet. You know, he works in Bitcoin security. He would work remotely, so he never had to go in to work with his colleagues. And enter a VPN service for home internet use. What is that?
VPN is a virtual privacy network. And this is actually something that a lot of people do today. They want to detach themselves from their IP address because they don't want marketers to be able to tell what they're doing online. They also don't want the government. You know, this is something that Chinese dissidents who want to access the full internet, they all need to be using VPNs. And so he created this VPN that was his entire house so that all of the traffic coming out of his house was obscured, looked like it was coming from an address somewhere else.
Well, I mean, he also does things the old-fashioned way. He says, master the art of disguise, get rid of a big beard that he had, give a hat and sunglasses, just try to blend into the crowd. But also, hire a private investigator to try to find you. And if they can't, you've succeeded.
Yeah, that was the final sort of fail-safe was pay people who are good at this to try to find you and see if they can do it. And they did, indeed, these private investigators he hired sort of found some holes in his system and helped him patch them up. And to Jameson, this is actually an ongoing experiment. He's continuing to go back every 6 months and seeing, you know, am I leaking information somewhere that I wasn't aware?
Boy, it's quite something. We'll link people at herenow.org to Nathaniel Popper's article in the New York Times about Jameson Lopps, the man who just erased himself. Nathaniel, listen, it's just us. So where is he?
I don't know. He said, I used to live in North Carolina. That much is known. He said, I may still live in North Carolina, but you're not going to find out. And there were a couple other things that he was coy about. He's sort of remarkably open given what he's involved in with all of this, but there were certain details he was going to be keeping to himself.
Well, Nathaniel Popper, if that's really your name, thank you for telling us about it. Thank you.
I'll be throwing away this phone number in just a few minutes.
And by the way, Jameson Lopp told Nathaniel it cost him about $30,000 all told to erase himself.
President Trump followed up today on his threat to close the border with Mexico this week if they don't stop all illegal immigration coming into the United States. He said he might start with tariffs on cars coming in from Mexico, but he hasn't withdrawn his threat to close the border. So how's this going over in Mexico? Let's bring in Carlos Puig, host on Milenio TV and columnist for Milenio Diario. He's with us on Skype from Sayulita, Mexico. And Carlos, I had a conversation yesterday with Adam Kennedy, deputy assistant to President Trump, and I asked him about the president's threat. Here's part of our conversation. So the president said last week on Twitter, if Mexico doesn't immediately stop all illegal immigration coming into the United States through our southern border, I will be closing the border or large sections of the border next week. That would be this week. So when is the closure going to happen?
Well, I think the president has seen more action from Mexico. I think he's seen some good progress. And I think the president is keeping all of his options open. I think what the president wants to do first and foremost is fulfill his primary responsibility to the American people, and that's securing American communities and protecting American lives.
What is the good progress that the president has seen in the last few days from Mexico?
Mexico has been setting up checkpoints. Mexico has been working with us to receive more people seeking asylum. Mexico has been an ongoing partner in this, and they've shown willingness to do even more.
It sounds like he's saying Mexico is doing new things in response to the threat to close the border. But in fact, has Mexico been doing these things all along?
That's exactly right. I mean, when I hear the deportation thing, I can tell you this deportation program it's a failure, but it's a failure because it has so many restrictions on who can you send to Mexico to wait for their asylum processes, etc. It has been going on for 2 months. So, no, nothing new has been done because you cannot mobilize hundreds of policemen to do a different job of immigration officers to do a different job. No, there's nothing new there. There are announcements that something new is going to happen maybe next month. But as facts, no, nothing new.
Do you think that there is more that Mexico could be doing to stem the flow of migrants from Central American countries who want to make their way through Mexico into the United States?
I really don't think there's a lot we can do. I mean, we have to look at what has happened between Mexico and the U.S. the last 40 years. It's very difficult to stop migration when migrants really want to go to other country. I mean, this is how migration works. It can be more orderly, maybe, We hope that the Central Americans are safer. We hope that we can capture or catch some of these horrible people that do horrible things to the migrants while they're in Mexico. But stem the flow, I mean, the history of the world says that's very difficult to do.
Why don't the migrants want to stay in Mexico?
Because they have this is a very interesting question. They have this view of the U.S. as this golden land where everything is going to happen. And let's say it, they have a lot of relatives and people they know in the U.S. The temporary protection that was given to them, 20, 30 years ago, brought a lot of Central Americans to live legally in the U.S. So a lot of these Guatemalans, Hondurans, Salvadorians have relatives, have people, friends, et cetera, that have been living in the U.S. And there's better employment. And yes, there is this view in Central America about the U.S. As the land where everything is okay.
I want to ask you about one more thing while we have you, which is the crisis in Venezuela. Venezuelans are fleeing their country. They're seeking safe haven in the region. And Mexico all along has remained neutral, has not recognized Juan Guaido as the rightful leader there. The U.S. and 50 other countries have. Why is Mexico remaining neutral on the issue of Venezuela?
Well, as we've discussed, and you know, we have a new government, a government that thinks itself as a government from the left, and a government that wants to go back to all the diplomatic Mexican traditions. I think it's wrong what the Mexican government is doing, but for sure the tradition in the 20th century for Mexico was this no intervention in decisions from another country in foreign affairs. I think some Mexicans would not see right the Mexican government taking a side. Mm-hmm. I think the Mexican government made a very bad bet when they say, hey, we're going to be neutral so we can mediate. Obviously, they don't know how bad that conflict is, how bad the situation in Venezuela is, and there is no mediation possible, I think, right now in Venezuela.
That is Carlos Puig joining us from Mexico. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And the story changes again. President Trump said last week it was going to be this week he'd close the border. Now he says he's giving Mexico a one-year warning. We will keep following this. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.